Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Toddcast. We're still seeing the images from Afghanistan, where the Taliban are consolidating control. And while the White House continues to play cleanup, two big questions remain. Was there any way to avoid the chaos we saw in Kabul? But more importantly, what does this all mean for America's foreign policy going forward? What is our organizing principle going forward? How does the fall of Afghanistan look to those watching in Taiwan, Ukraine, Myanmar, Belarus? Well, joining me today, Jim Steinberg. He was Deputy Secretary of State for President Obama and Bill Clinton's Deputy National Security Advisor. And Bruce Gentleson. He's a professor of public policy at Duke University and the author of The Peacemakers, Leadership Lessons from 20th Century Statesmanship. Jim and Bruce, welcome to the Toddcast. And as I was saying to you guys off air, I'm going to dive into, you know, all the different ways, all the different moments where we could make a case of what went wrong with Afghanistan. But it really is a what now? And I guess to start that conversation, Jim, is Joe Biden right? Was basically this bit of chaos inevitable no matter when we left?
I'm not sure the specific level of chaos was inevitable. I think that the general outcome probably was. I think that we faced a situation in which, after 20 years, the Afghan government had never developed enough confidence in its own people and an effective governance strategy to be able to rally a very important part of the Afghan public that doesn't want the Taliban around a different government. They just weren't able to create that kind of commitment, loyalty that would make it necessary. But that doesn't mean that the end game couldn't have been smoother. And I think it's a legitimate question to ask whether this had been thought through enough to prepare for this very dramatic case.
I'm curious, Jim, how much do you think, you know, one of my leading theories on all of this is, you know, everybody hears what they want to hear at any briefing they get. Do you think it fell on a little bit of deaf ears, Jim, when the intel community or the Pentagon would warn the White House, look, this could unravel fast. We think it'll hold. Do you think this was a case where the warnings weren't there or people heard what they wanted to hear?
So I wasn't there, so it's hard to say. But I will say from the outside, one of the things that hasn't really been paid enough attention to is what I suspect was a worry on the part of the administration that if they prepared for the worst case, it would become a self-fulfilling prophecy. That is, it would by saying that we think
this compelling argument to me for what it's worth. It does feel a little chicken and egg here, doesn't it?
Yes. And, you know, I mean, the problem is they didn't want to pull the rug out under the Afghan government by saying, well, it's hopeless. They're not going to survive. We need to plan for their collapse. They wanted to try to give the Afghan government a chance. So in some ways, the more you prepare for this bad scenario, the more you guarantee it's going to happen. And I suspect that was part of the calculation. But we still need a full real investigation into what was known, what was briefed, and what choices were looked at in terms of this very bad contingency as it played out.
So, Bruce, looking forward, what kind of impact? I mean, if you're in Taiwan today, how nervous are you?
Yeah, you know, what you're really raising, Chuck, is this whole question that gets thrown a lot about credibility. American credibility is at stake. And the problem with that argument is some people say credibility is all about resolve, you know, stay in the course, even if it's a terrible course. But it's also about judgment, you know, and to know when you really have vital interests at stake and when you have a viable strategy. I mean, you go back to Vietnam when somebody like George Kennan, the eminent realist, opposed Vietnam from the beginning. He said, Berlin's credibility, Saigon's not. So if you're in Taiwan or elsewhere, it's really a matter of do we see our interests as sufficiently significant in those areas to do what we need to do to deter China and reassure Taiwan and the same elsewhere? And I think that's not a messaging, a communication strategy. It's a core part of you know, the way you communicate your foreign policy. So I think the credibility really is about judgment. And in that sense, I agree with Jim, it was the right decision. Very poorly executed. And that's where you do have a credibility problem. The Europeans and others saying, hey, guys, you know, I thought you worked with us, right? It's not so much that you needed to stay there, but you really messed us up in the way you've gone about it as well.
When you say, Bruce, you would have gone to the UN, would you have tried to like have them as sort of the almost overseeing, you know, the transition between the Taliban and the Afghan government? Do you view them as almost sort of the intermediary occupying force?
No.
Well, what did you envision there if it was a UN transition? What would that have looked like in your
Opinion? You know, I think we got to be careful about Monday morning quarterbacking. You know, like Jim was saying, none of us were in the room. And there are a couple of things I think that you can say. That's one of them. I mean, it seems to me that for the humanitarian transition, that trying to go to the UN and getting some support, not necessarily a military force, but even from the human rights elements and the, you know, High Commissioner on Refugees, and helping it and making it clear that what the United States wasn't the only one that had the responsibility or the capability to prevent really awful things from happening. And frankly, if we got opposed at the UN, you know, by Russia, China, or elsewhere, it would have been clear to the international community that, that what's happened isn't totally our fault. So there are two sides to it. One, to make it better. And the other is, if it did go bad, to be in a position to have others, you know, have to take some of the hits.
Jim, why do you think that might, something like that wasn't pursued? Or do you just think it was, we were at just sort of a, there was just nothing else. There was no more resolve, I guess, internally. It was sort of like, look, there's no good way to go now, so let's just get out.
Again, I think it's hard to say because we don't know what options were actually considered. I think that there's a clear indication the president was very determined to get out, and that basically saw that this was going to end one way or the other. And I think that there was a sort of an unwillingness to push the envelope to think about the kinds of adjustments that could be made to deal with that determination to get out. And I think the failure to be creative about this, the failure to think about all the contingencies, is why so many people are concerned. And yet I think there is a danger that was obvious from the warnings that we have seen that we could end up in this place. So you had a very strong conviction from the president, who even when he was vice president had grave reservations about the whole mission. And that clearly, I think, overshadowed all of the thinking.
Jim, is one of the mistakes, did we oversell the Taliban as a potential enemy? Did we underestimate them did we only view them two dimensionally, if you will, as just sort of a semi authoritative aspect? Should we have dealt with them differently from the beginning?
We have dealt with them a fair amount. And as many of the stories that have come out, there was a lot of effort during the Obama administration in which I served to try to find a diplomatic solution led by Ambassador Holbrooke. So I think there was a recognition that the Taliban was a force that had to be dealt with, that had important support among the Afghan people, although a lot of opposition among the Afghan people as well, and that there wasn't going to be a long-term solution that didn't take into account the considerable support that the Taliban had. Whether they're an enemy of the United States remains an open question. There's no doubt that at the end of the 1990s and leading up to 9/11, that the Taliban were complicit in providing a safe haven for the actions of al-Qaeda that led up to 9/11. And I think people are rightly skeptical about whether the Taliban can be counted on not to repeat that. So I think it's wariness about Taliban's intentions, not so much the government itself, but its willingness to support other radical groups and harbor other radical groups, is a legitimate concern.
So, Bruce, this seemed to be to get at sort of what made Afghanistan. Is it in our national security interest? Well, the Taliban is not a direct threat to the United States, but it's what the Taliban could help invite or provide safe haven for that makes it a national security concern. So, you know, how should we, you know, what is the likelihood that they're that they become more like an ISIS, where they're sort of symbolically viewed as sort of the main attraction in the jihadist movement?
Yeah, I think the jihadist movement is a lot more crowded, as it were, than it was back in the late 90s, early 2000s, right? And you know, we have special ops and other forces deployed in well over 100 countries dealing with counterterrorism missions. And the president has said that he was going to continue the counterterrorism mission, that you didn't need to be there to do it. And granted, there's some issues people have raised about intelligence and the like. So, you know, I think it's really important to look at different scenarios about what the Taliban is. You know, one of them is not nice guy, right? But, you know, to govern, you know, are they going to put their focus on what they need to do internally? Otherwise, they'll be like everything else in Afghanistan. They're going to have, it's already starting, you know, resistance to the Taliban up in among various tribes and other groups. There are still UN sanctions on the Taliban, and they would have to, we would have to vote for a lifting of them. And you're already seeing countries in the region are saying, you know, whoa, our interests are at stake here too, now that you Americans have lost. The Russians are worried about Central Asia, the Chinese about, you know, the Uyghurs, the Pakistanis already are seeing the Pakistani Taliban picking up its attacks. And, you know, the Afghan Taliban, maybe, thank you very much. We don't need you as much anymore. I mean, you go down the list, India, Saudi Arabia, Iran. So there are countries to work with here about, you know, limiting what the Taliban can do. And that requires sort of a strategic diplomacy, which isn't just about, you know, who negotiates with whom, but, you know, finding ways to bring pressure, because there are a lot of security threats that they pose to a lot of countries, not just us.
Jim, the biggest leverage we have is financial, right? We froze all the accounts for the government. There's a lot of, and it does seem as if the Taliban is interested in trying to govern. And that interest may lead them to look for some money that they may believe, hey, we're running Afghanistan now. Help us out here. Is that leverage worth using if you're the United States, or is there too much? Is there just too hard politically to ever give the Taliban money?
Count me skeptical about how much leverage we have. I think that the Taliban, certainly they wouldn't mind having the money, but I don't think they're terribly dependent on it. One has to worry about the drug trade and some of the other illicit activities which have financed the Taliban in the past. They have other sources of support. We saw back in the early days, they essentially got payments by countries that were interested in trying to essentially pay off kind of extortion from the Taliban. And so I'm not sure I understand the sanctions and the desire to sort of play the usual game of trying to have economic leverage, either incentives or disincentives. But I'm not sure how critical that is to the Taliban or its ability to rule. I think they're not interested in building a vibrant middle-class society in Afghanistan. So the resources that they need, I think it can be had without necessarily acquiescing to what the U.S. would like them to do.
If others like China or Russia are creating diplomatic ties with the Taliban, does it sort of force our hand?
No, I mean, we play a very different hand. You know, we're in a very different position. They're being very clever, and they are playing both sides of the street. You know, the Russians are doing military maneuvers around the border of the Tajikistan now because they're concerned about that area. The Chinese have already gone through links between some elements among the Uyghurs, and most of the Uyghurs are not posing a terrorism threat, you know, notwithstanding what Beijing says. So they're all trying to work out their relationship. And I think that there are some slivers of common ground there that, you know, when you're looking for, you know, ways in which you can work the situation, those are really important. And so part of what happened, the way we've executed this is it's all on us, right? I mean, a lot would have been anyway, but the way we've mishandled it, you know, has made it look like, in the same way we said we could make the difference for 20 years and we couldn't, now it's about us making the difference in a really negative way during this transition.
I'm going to pause there. We'll be right back after a quick break. You are listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press.
Join Hoda Kotb for a brand new season of her podcast, Making Space.
For season 5, I am making space to talk to people who are providing a sense of hope and inspiration when life changes course.
Uplifting conversations with inspiring individuals like NFL legend Drew Brees, singer-songwriter Ziggy Marley, and Today Show co-anchor Savannah Guthrie as you have never heard her before.
I found faith more viscerally, not because the bad thing didn't happen, but because it did.
I promise you, like me, will leave these conversations with some wisdom for your own journey, empowered and inspired to make space in your own life.
New episodes of Making Space with Hoda Kotb are released every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
If you ever needed to be persuaded that bad things can happen anywhere, then take a journey with us.
From compelling mysteries to in-depth investigations, our Dateline episodes are available as podcasts.
Follow Dateline NBC now to get new episodes every Tuesday. To listen ad-free, subscribe to Dateline Premium on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or datelinepremium.com.
Great storytelling with a twist from the true crime original.
Jim, how damaged do you think the relationship is between the Pentagon and the White House right now?
I think that there are always tensions in situations like this because there's a tendency when things don't go well to try to apportion blame. The Pentagon had some views. We'll learn more in the weeks to come in terms of what was actually recommended to the president and what was not done. But I think the military leaders and the Pentagon, familiar with President Biden's viewpoint, these debates were had at great length during the Obama administration, and then Vice President Biden was very clear about his perspective on this. So I think they had a good sense of where the president was coming from, and they understand that that's the nature of our system, is that this is the civilian control of the military, and the civilians make the decisions. I think what will be important for them is for the civilians to take responsibility for the decisions that were made. And I think if that's the case, then the military will understand that they may have had different views, but this is ultimately a decision for the elected officials and not for the military to make.
What more rhetorical work do you think the president has to do? What was missing from his speech earlier this week?
I think the most important thing that was missing was a recognition that this has not gone well, and that one has to do some serious soul searching about why it didn't go well. That even though, as we've said, and I agree, that the fundamental decision to get out was the right one, it's hard to simply kind of shrug your shoulders and say that this had to go as badly as it did. And so one would like to hear from the president a recognition that, as he looks back on this, that one needs to look hard at the decision-making process and whether all the alternatives were looked at. What was the intelligence? How well was it scrutinized? Were the different contingencies really evaluated and creativity shown about the options to deal with what turns out to be a very bad case?
No, Chuck,
hey, Bruce.
Chuck, you said something at the beginning on the point Jim's making, and not to get too wonky about it, but it's like the difference when you're looking at these things between what you treat as a premise, you take as a given, and what's kind of a proposition that you look at the evidence and you test. And I think that's really important because you've got a team here. You know, Jim knows these are all people we know well, and they're closely knit. They've worked together before. But sometimes that can be a negative where you all go in with the same assumptions, and it's harder to open them up. And I think going forward, a useful thing for the team to think about, you know, how to open up some of those assumptions that are worth doing more contingency planning and looking at more versions of them as you think through your options.
I want to have you both answer the following question, but you'll do it from different perspectives, which is, Jim, why during your time during dealing with this, why do you think you never could convince a President Obama or then Vice President Biden that Bagram should be like, that we should treat Afghanistan like Korea, like Japan, like Germany, that's the future, that it's we're not fighting the Taliban, we're not fighting the civil war, but we do have some interests here, and we're going to be a stabilizing presence. Was that a viable, why wasn't that something that either President Obama or Vice President Biden embraced?
Because they're very, very different situations. In none of those cases were we there to stabilize the internal situation in those countries. We were there to help those countries deal with an external threat in which they wanted our support, fairly broad-based support for our presence there, and that we were working with a functioning government. In Korea, it evolved over time in terms of how democratic that government was, but that we were there largely with shared security interests against an external threat. Here, the problem was we were dealing with a fundamentally internal problem in which the country was very divided, in which we tried to help create a broad-based government that had the support of its people that could stand on its own. And that's a very different thing to do indefinitely if it appears after the kind of effort that was made over a period of time, both on the security, the economic, and the political front, that the government was simply not able to develop the kind of support for its, from its own people. So I think that it's overworked, and there are obviously important differences. But I do think that there are important parts of the story of Vietnam that still has to be thought about in this context.
You know, Bruce, I guess there's a sort of a practical reason I ask this question is handing over Bagram really looks like a weird decision now. And I didn't fully understand it then.
Well, I think at Jim's point, you know, that Germany and Korea have been about restraining aggression from the outside. You know, you're deterring somebody from coming into the country. And Bagram is inside the country. I mean, it's the notion that we should keep 1,000 troops there and have a CT mission. How do you separate that from all this, you know, trying to do nation building and stuff? You really can't when the issue is inside the country. Germany and Korea had political differences, but they didn't have tribal and ethnic groups, you know, doing insurgencies, killing each other. And Afghan long has and long will. So I don't think there was an option, you know, even a small presence in the country was the thin end of the wedge that would have kept going. And I do agree with the point that I thought the president holding his ground on the right decision was the right thing to do. But there really does need to be a sense of, we get it. This hasn't worked. I'm not going to say it's all our fault, but I'm going to take a close look at it so we can see what to do next here and what we can learn from this, you know, going forward. And that was missing. And I think that was a big mistake for him politically as well as strategically.
You know, Jim, it seems as if the president's convinced he was right about the surge the first time, or he wouldn't have brought it up in his speech. Is that too simplistic?
I think the key question here, and I think, Chuck, getting to your broader question about the long-term implications about this, is whether the takeaway will be we should never do things like this. We should just never get involved. It never comes out well, so we should just kind of stand back. And I think that a lot of what the vice president saw back in the Obama administration was reflecting a sense that we should never have even begun this enterprise. And it's a serious debate. And my own view is that it was worth the effort to do this. And that once we were forced to get involved because of 9/11, that there were good reasons to try to give it a shot and to see whether it was possible to give the people of Afghanistan a brighter future. There are risks, there are no guarantees, but there's also tremendous benefits for the United States being seen as willing to try to help out and try to create a better future. But it doesn't mean that we have to be a guarantor of that future. And I think that the reason why I think President Obama got it right in 2009, but President Biden now is right in the basic decision to get out, is that it was worth giving it a try. But we also learned that there's a limit to how much you can do, and you can't always succeed.
You know, Bruce, if the mission now is counterterrorism, is this a case where technology has sort of caught us up and perhaps the need, why we needed to be in Afghanistan in the first decade of the 21st century, given the advancement in drones, given our, you know, look at what we're doing, you know, hey, yes, we fight in Syria, but we don't say we're fighting in Syria, you know, which is, you can sort of envision that's perhaps our future when it comes to dealing with threats that emanate inside of Afghanistan. Is that a case where technology allows us to do this a bit easier?
I think we've done a lot of things, including the technology since 9/11, you know, to increase our capacity to defend ourselves. I think the big question for us is the resiliency one. You know, if there's another major attack, and even if we hadn't gotten out of Afghanistan, you know, what's going to be the reaction of the society and the country? And that's where I still have a lot of concern, especially now where things get, you know, I mean, look at what's being exploited over the Afghanistan decision by people that were looking, you know, in a very different direction before. And, you know, I just remember I was a graduate student in London in the 70s when the IRA was doing attacks on Harrods and stuff. And, you know, the British been through a lot. They'd been through the Blitz and they showed some resiliency for many years. Actually, the Israelis did too. I think they've lost a little bit of that society. So I actually worry, you know, what will one major attack do to our society, not just to Biden's political future? And I worry a lot about our society's capacity to, you know, to deal with that effectively, but not kind of go crazy.
Jim, does this make a humanitarian-based foreign policy more of a aspiration? Or, I mean, I say that you're a veteran of the Clinton administration, and one of the arguably the most successful humanitarian based military decision we made when it comes to Central Europe in Kosovo. Is that still going to be an organizing principle, particularly when Democrats are in charge of a White House or not?
I think it's very important for the administration to give some serious thought to this and to be clear about what this means in terms of their views about human rights and what the responsibilities are for the United States with respect to human rights. Because there's no question that the consequence of the Taliban takeover is going to lead to such a dramatic deterioration of the human rights situation in Afghanistan that despite the promises that we're hearing, I think nobody has any great expectations or hopes that this will turn into a progressive, open society. And so the administration, I think, needs to talk about what this means for its own overall agenda and how it's going to deal with the fact that there are regimes out there that don't share our views and that there's a limited willingness on our part to try to change that. And I think the kind of candor and willingness to step up to the plate and discuss this, not that we don't care, but to recognize what we think we can and can't do and what the long-term strategy is to deal with these problems will be very important, because I think a lot of questions are going to be raised because the administration has put such an emphasis on the values part of its foreign policy.
So Bruce, like how would you advise him to articulate between how we worry about women who are treated in Saudi Arabia, an ally, Afghanistan, the Uyghurs in China, what is our animating principle? Cuba, what is our animating principle?
Yeah, I think that we do a lot more about the human rights violations among adversaries than among allies. And if you actually take the Hippocratic Oath to start by doing no harm, we can have more impact on Saudi Arabia, on Egypt, Latin American militaries back in the 70s and the 80s. And so that's a starting point, to be less a part of the problem. And then when it comes to these other countries, that goes back to a point Jim made earlier. I mean, we put sanctions on the Chinese for the Uyghurs and on Hong Kong. We both remember the Tiananmen Square ones back in 1993. And they don't have much impact. The Navalny sanctions don't have much impact. And we can say we're standing up for principles. But, a lot of times these sanctions have negative humanitarian consequences, right? There's this de-risking that banks and insurance companies do where they say the American laws are so crazy and the penalty is so great that I'm not even going to help NGOs in Syria, right? And so we really got to think it through, not just sort of, what's good in a speech.
But I think what you're both saying is that's something the president also owes us here, sort of a better articulated sort of organizing principle, that's for sure. This conversation could, I imagine, is going to continue a lot in all of your worlds, but I'm going to have to end it here. Jim Steinberg, Bruce Gentleson, thank you both.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Justice Gilpin Green, Megan Leibowitz, and Matt Rivera. John Reese is our executive producer. Our theme music composed by Spoke Media. You can catch Meet the Press daily on MSNBC. It's every weekday at 1. Meet the Press reports on demand on Peacock. Subscribe to that, download the app, etc. The Big Show is available every Sunday morning, pretty much on any platform you want to use. Thanks for listening. Until we upload it.